the headlines, a Canadian Indigenous leader calls on Pope Francis to apologize for the abuse of Aboriginal children at church-run schools in the country. The U.S. military takes responsibility for killing 23 civilians around the world in 2020. Watchdog groups say that the number is far lower than the reality on the ground. And Iran's lead negotiator in the Vienna talks to revive the 2015 nuclear accord says it's time for the U.S. and European signatories to make difficult decisions. Hello and welcome everybody here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. Our top story for this half-hour, Canadian Indigenous leader has asked for a papal apology for the abuse at the country's Catholic-run former residential schools for Indigenous children.
For the Roman Catholic Church to continue not to apologize, I think will be a crime. They have to apologize. I'm talking about the Pope now.
Joseph described the residential school system operated in the country for about a century as a destructive tool to oppress the native people and control their lives. His appeal comes as Canada's Indigenous Services Minister Mark Miller has already condemned as shameful the lack of a formal apology from the Pope over the issue. Last week, a mass grave containing remains of 215 children was found at a former residential school in the province of British Columbia.
Canada has touted itself as the first country in the world to adopt a multiculturalism policy. The North American country has also depicted itself as an outspoken critic of racism and a leading advocate of human rights in the international arena. However, mounting evidence on racism and discrimination against minorities, in particular Aboriginal people, proves the contrary. Last week, the remains of more than 200 children, some as young as 3 years old, were found at the site of a former residential school for Indigenous children in the province of British Columbia. The Kamloops School operated between 1890 and 1969 when the federal government took over operations from the Catholic Church and turned it into a day school until it was closed in 1978. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau said the discovery was a painful reminder of a shameful chapter of Canada's history. Indigenous groups also demanded a nationwide search for mass graves at former residential school sites. Vigils were also held to commemorate the victims.
It's really a tragedy for having those priests and those nuns running those schools, raping and killing and murdering and abusing those Indigenous children. And it really takes effect into all the younger generation, that intergenerational trauma.
When I heard about the 250 children who, you know, were discovered, their remains were discovered in a residential school mass graveyard, my heart was absolutely broken. I've been sort of in a grieving mode since.
Between the 1870s and 1990s, more than 150,000 Indigenous children were forced to attend these schools, which were run by churches and aimed to forcibly assimilate Indigenous children into white Canadian society. The children were separated from their families and barred from speaking Indigenous languages, and many experienced physical, psychological, and sexual abuse, among other forms of mistreatment. More than 4,000 Indigenous children are known to have died at residential schools, but efforts continue to try to find others who never returned home. In 2015, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission of Canada concluded that the country committed cultural genocide with its decades-long residential school system. Such a system is just the tip of the iceberg, since reports suggest thousands of Indigenous women and girls have also been murdered or gone missing in Canada in the last 30 years. Irrespective of decades of structural and systematic discrimination against Indigenous people, which have been denounced by prominent rights groups, Canada also grapples with some other serious human rights issues, including persistent exports of military equipment to countries with a record human rights violations. However, Canada has time and again blamed countries such as Iran, China, and Venezuela for violating human rights. For now, the discovery of bodies at the former boarding school has once again turned a spotlight on Canada's claim about being a human rights advocate.
Elsewhere, an Australian court has been presented with hundreds of photographs of Aussie soldiers drinking from the prosthetic leg of a slain Afghan national. The photos were presented by lawyers for soldiers suing several media outlets for defamation. The publication of potentially incriminating photos of Australian soldiers drinking alcohol from the artificial limb in December 2020 followed the conclusion of a four-year probe that found credible evidence of war crimes committed by Aussie troops in Afghanistan. A newspaper alleged in 2009 that a soldier shot dead an Afghan civilian and brought the prosthetic leg as a, quote, souvenir. The defamation case against the Australian media was filed in response to a series of reports published in 2018 wherein the soldier was accused of war crimes, which his lawyers deny as baseless and false. Political commentator Tim Anderson says the evidence of probes into war crimes committed by Australian troops in Afghanistan risk the entire image of the country's presence in the country.
It's a very important story in Australia because it, as even some corporate journalists are recognising now, the defamation case brought on by former soldier Ben Robert Smith, it's a prelude to possible prosecution of Robert Smith for war crimes in Afghanistan. And while he has the backing of one media billionaire, some of the other media chains are pressing that this case is able to be reported on freely. So it's initiated a conflict between media billionaires, all of whom normally support all of the wars in the Middle East, but they're at odds over this. And it's also called into question the entire role of Australian involvement in Afghanistan, which was considered, quote, the good war, unquote, compared to the other dirty wars in the region. The entire edifice and the image of the Australian involvement in the war in Afghanistan is at risk here. And it may be that the defamation case in advance of criminal charges is going to bring that to a much wider public and start to determine the matter in people's minds here.
News review, where we look deeper into some of the top stories of the day. On this edition, the U.S. military says nearly two dozen civilians were killed in its operations in foreign war zones last year. According to the Defense Department, 23 civilians lost their lives and nearly 10 were wounded in separate operations in Iraq, Afghanistan, Somalia, Yemen, and Nigeria in 2020. In its report, the Pentagon confirmed that 20 civilians were killed in Afghanistan alone. The report also acknowledged that the families of victims were not compensated by the Pentagon. However, the Pentagon tally on civilian killings is much lower than those provided by NGOs. Some NGOs put civilian casualties in U.S. foreign wars last year at around 100 and above. They blast the U.S. military's investigations and acknowledgement of civilian deaths as, quote, woefully inadequate. They also slam the Pentagon for failing to pay damages to impacted civilians and families. And joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have Professor of Media Practice and Philosophy at Coventry University, Mr. Kenneth Farrow, joining us from London. Also, we have a research fellow at the Global Policy Institute, Mr. George Samueli, joining us from Budapest. Let's start off with Mr. Farrow in London. Sir, do you believe these numbers? Kenneth Farrow. All right, let's take that question to Mr. Samueli in Budapest until we get back with our guest in London. Mr. Samueli, what about you? Do you believe these numbers, or do you perceive them to be too low at this point? All right, unfortunately, it seems that we've lost both connections for our guests on this edition of the News Review, but hopefully we'll be hearing from our guests later on in the program if we get them back. Moving on. Iran's lead delegate to nuclear talks in Vienna says a final agreement depends on how much the U.S. and European sides are prepared to adjust themselves with the legitimate demands of the Islamic Republic. Abu Sadalchi says the talks are not close to the point of reaching a deal. Homolinsky reports.
The fifth round of talks between Iran and the remaining signatories of the nuclear deal known as the JCPOA concludes in Vienna. The objective, to bring the U.S. back into the deal and to ensure the full implementation of Iran's nuclear commitments. EU coordinator Enrico Mora said the sticking points are fewer than they were a week ago.
It's a complex process with political decisions, with rather technical issues. They go in parallel. Now we are reaching a point in which we have to face the hard decisions. That's why it's only logical that head of delegations will go back to capitals. They will expose to their authorities the situation, and they will come back, I hope, with new, fresh ideas to finally close the negotiation.
Iranian lead delegate Deputy Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi said although the sides have made good progress, some key issues still need to be resolved. Iran has demanded the removal of all sanctions imposed, reimposed, or relabeled under the former U.S. administration, saying it would only return to full compliance after the verification of sanctions removal.
It is certainly the other side who has to make difficult decisions. What we need to do at the same time is on the implementation plans, decide on the methods and ways which meet our interest most. But for the US, for the other side, for Europeans, it is time to make difficult decisions. And I hope that they would be able to do that.
The Joint Commission will meet again in a week's time. And though the EU coordinator said he is absolutely sure the next round will be the last, Iran's lead delegate opted for a more cautious stance, saying that nothing can be predicted in such difficult negotiations. Homar Lesgib, Vienna.
One more Palestinian succumbs to injuries he had sustained during Israel's last month aggression on the Gaza Strip. According to the Palestinian media, the victim is a young man named Yahya Bassem al-Ajla. His death brings to nearly 260 the number of Gazans lost their lives in days of Israeli airstrikes and shelling. At least 66 of those killed were children. According to Gaza's health ministry, over 1,900 people were also injured before a ceasefire took effect on May the 21st. The 11-day onslaught also left much of Gaza's critical infrastructure in shambles. Many civilian buildings were either badly damaged or completely leveled in Israeli bombardments. The International Criminal Court, ICC, is in pursuit of investigating Israeli violations in the occupied Palestinian territories. This move was not only rejected by Israel, but also its staunch supporter, the United States. Now major European officials have come out formally signing a letter to prevent any obstruction in the ICC's pursuit of justice.
An open letter by dozens of European officials. The purpose, to end unwarranted public criticism of inquiries into alleged Israeli war crimes in Palestine. Such is the context of an apparent push by 50 European officials to have the ICC complete its investigation. These officials include former foreign ministers, prime ministers, and senior international officials, including two British Conservative former ministers. Roadblocks were thrown the ICC's way when the inquiry opened. The administration of former U.S. President Donald Trump sanctioned ICC court officials from pursuing the matter, something the new U.S. administration reversed.
Well, Donald Trump's position was highly criticized by various governments and many other people because it was, just totally out of line. There's no question in my mind that Israel's committed human rights violations, and to exempt Israel from any sort of scrutiny is a travesty of justice.
The ICC has less to worry about, at least for now. The letter reads that the purpose of the court is well established and recognized, that accountability for serious rights violations by all sides through conflict is essential for achieving sustainable and lasting peace. The key question is, will the ICC's findings be grounds for holding anyone accountable for prosecution if guilty of war crimes and human rights violations?
Israel's afraid that there will be international warrants issued for various Israeli officials who participated in the planning and directing the attack on Gaza. Gaza is the most densely populated place on the planet. And, you know, if you look at the pictures, you know, whole families were targeted and killed. And it's grossly disproportionate in terms of what the Palestinians were doing. And Israel's attack on Palestinians in Jerusalem was the initial cause of that, which is also very troubling.
The former Danish foreign minister and former president of the UN General Assembly have said a rules-based global order is predicated upon the idea that violations of international law must be met with consequences.
Elsewhere, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's opponents have secured a coalition deal potentially putting an end to his 12-year rule. Opposition leader Yair Lapid has notified President Reuven Rivlin that he can form a power-sharing cabinet. The announcement came after the United Arab List Party joined the coalition. Lapid has spearheaded the efforts to form the coalition and managed to garner the backing of far-right politician Naftali Bennett. Under the deal, Bennett will serve as prime minister for 2 years before being replaced by Lapid for the second half of the term. Author and journalist Eric Wahlberg says the Israeli policies aren't likely to change under the new coalition cabinet.
I'm not very optimistic. Bennett, who will be the first 2 years prime minister, was adamant that no, he would not serve in a coalition with any Arabs. So that was been his stance all along. So I guess he's changed enough to get rid of Netanyahu. That seems to be the only interest that he is, because his politics, when there are so many parties and they claim to be left and right, but for someone from outside, they all look the same to me. They're all Zionists. They all believe that Israel is a state of Jews only, and that Palestinians, any Arabs, anyone else is by the Constitution is a second category person. So I don't see really much changing. In fact, some of the commentators think it will be worse.
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of the World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight.
U.S. President Joe Biden has used the centenary of the Tulsa race massacre as a rallying cry for America to be honest about its history, insisting that great nations come to terms with their dark sides. On On Tuesday, 1st of June, Joe Biden became the first sitting U.S. president to visit the site where, on 31st of May and 1st of June 1921, exactly 100 years ago, a white mob murdered up to 300 African Americans and burnt and looted homes and businesses, raising a prosperous community known as Black Wall Street. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnist David Smith. The piece is titled, Joe Biden Calls for U.S. to Confront Its Past on 100th Anniversary of Tulsa Massacre. U.S. President Joe Biden has used the centenary of the Tulsa race massacre as a rallying cry for America to be honest about its history, insisting that great nations come to terms with their dark sides. On Tuesday, 1st of June, Joe Biden became the first sitting U.S. president to visit the site where, on 31st of May and 1st of June 1921, exactly 100 years ago, a white mob murdered up to 300 African Americans and burnt and looted homes and businesses, raising a prosperous community known as Black Wall Street. Biden pleaded for America to confront its past and admit that a thread of hatred runs from Tulsa, Oklahoma, through more recent displays of white supremacy in Charlottesville, Virginia, and, most recently, at the U.S. Capitol in Washington, D.C. on 6th of January this year. He also drew a connection to a Republican assault on the voting rights of people of color and announced that Kamala Harris, the first woman of color to serve as vice president, would lead the White House effort to resist it. Biden began by speaking directly to the last three survivors of the Tulsa race massacre, centenarians Viola Mother Fletcher, Hugh's Uncle Red Van Ellis, and Lessie Benningfield Randall, who received a standing ovation from an audience of around 200, made up of survivors and their families, community leaders, and elected officials. You are the three known remaining survivors of a story seen in the mirror dimly, but no longer, said Biden, a comparatively youthful 78-year-old. But now your story will be known in full view, he said. Knowledge of this violent attempt to suppress black success in Greenwood, Tulsa, Oklahoma, fell victim to a decades-long conspiracy of silence. The atrocity was not taught in schools, even in Tulsa, Oklahoma itself, until the mid-2000s, and was expunged from police records. Those who threatened to break to the taboo faced disapproval of or even death threats. Even many black residents preferred not to burden their children with the story. Joe Biden said, for much too long, the history of what took place here was told in silence, cloaked in darkness. But just because history is silent, it doesn't mean that it did not take place. And while darkness can hide much, it erases nothing. Some injustices are so heinous, so horrific, so grievous, they can't be buried, no matter how hard people try. So it is here. Only with truth can come healing and justice and repair. The argument was a striking contrast to his predecessor Donald Trump, who promoted a heroic vision of American history. On the massacre's 99th anniversary, Donald Trump had posed with a Bible outside a historic church after security forces tear gassed protesters outside the White House. Donald Trump headed to Tulsa later that month for a campaign rally that breached coronavirus safety guidelines. After studying an exhibition on this lost boomtown at the Greenwood Cultural Center in Tulsa, Joe Biden's message appeared to be the opposite of Make America Great Again, an acknowledgement that America's history includes slavery and segregation, and that only looking that fully in the face can allow it to move forward. Challenging the language used to describe the one of the worst chapters in America's history of racial violence, the president followed a moment of silence with a pointed statement. "My fellow Americans, this was not a riot. This was a massacre." Joe Biden went on, "among the worst in America's history, but not the only one, and for too long forgotten by our history. As soon as it happened, there was a clear effort to erase it from our memory, our collective memory. We can't just choose to learn what we want to know and not what we should know." Joe Biden continued, "we should know the good, the bad, everything. That's what great nations do. They come to terms with their dark sides, and we're a great nation." The president also noted that whilst Greenwood's black community recovered, it was marginalized again by housing redlining and urban renewal projects, including highways, a pattern seen in many American cities. Biden promised that his administration would address racism at its root, expanding federal contracting with small disadvantaged businesses, investing billions of dollars in communities like Greenwood, and pursuing new efforts to combat housing discrimination. Notably, Biden also used the platform to condemn efforts in recent months by Republican state legislatures to impose voting restrictions, likely to have a disproportionate impact on people of color, as a truly unprecedented assault on democracy. Biden said he had asked Kamala Harris, his vice president, to lead his administration's effort to protect voting rights. "With her leadership and your support, we're going to overcome again, but it's going to take a hell of a lot of work," he said. So, Vice President Kamala Harris released a statement that noted that almost 400 bills have been introduced at the state level since the last presidential election to make it more difficult for some people to vote. "The work ahead of us is to make voting accessible to all American voters and to make sure every vote is counted through a free, fair, and transparent process," Kamala Harris said. President Biden has made numerous policy speeches as president, but the convergence of history, racial justice, and the audience on Tuesday seemed to strike a particular chord in him. It was the neo-Nazi march in Charlottesville, Virginia, in 2017 that moved Biden to end political retirement and run for president again. What happened in Greenwood, Tulsa, Oklahoma, was an act of hate and domestic terrorism, with the through line that exists today still, he said, prompting a cry of assent from the audience. "Just close your eyes and remember what you saw in Charlottesville, Virginia, 4 years ago on television." Biden added that Viola Mother Fletcher, 107 years old, said the 6th of January insurrection, when a mob of Donald Trump's supporters stormed the U.S. Capitol, broke her heart, and reminded her of what happened here in Greenwood, Tulsa, Oklahoma, 100 years ago. He noted that hate crimes continue to target Asian Americans and Jewish Americans. "Hate's never defeated, it only hides. It hides, and given just a little bit of oxygen by its leaders, it comes out from under the rock like it's happening again, as if it never went away. So folks, we must not give hate a safe harbor."
hot debate.
Hello, welcome to the debate. Why do far-right extremist ideologies have a presence in the British military? Or should the question be, why is there such an attraction for far-right ideology from UK servicemen and UK soldiers? The soldiers, Air Force, and Naval personnel were among those who were investigated, actually, in the past 2.5 years under PREVENT, a program which aims to stop people from becoming radicalized. Yet these very same service members need to be the role models for the rest to follow. Far-right extremism in the UK military and service members, the subject of this edition of the debate.
Armed Forces' allure for far-right extremists is believed to be as old as British fascism's earliest incarnations. At least 16 members of the country's armed forces investigated over the past 2.5 years have been referred to the UK's so-called PREVENT scheme, a controversial terrorism prevention program.
The British Army is seen as being a defense of Britain and British values, but those British values are rooted in racism, as I say, and also in its history of colonialism and empire. The British military is in itself a racist institution because Britain is a racist society.
The UK Ministry of Defence is yet to release exact figures, but it says the number of investigations in 2020 was less than 10, and those so far this year, less than 5. Critics say, despite the MOD's stated commitment to zero tolerance for far-right extremists, operating within the armed forces, its strong words have not always led to strong action.
Of course, the British government is going to say there's a zero tolerance policy, but that is nothing in keeping with the reality when it comes to the culture that exists within the British Army because of its role, because of its history, because of its legacy, and because of its identity. The far right is on the march, not just in the UK, but throughout the West. This is a result of the socio-economic problems ushered in by the 2008 economic collapse, and the far right have been able to point the fingers at migrants and refugees and existing minority communities as being the problem. I think that this is just the tip of the iceberg. I think it goes far, far deeper, and I think there's a cover-up abroad in consequence.
Of the 14 investigations carried out in 2019 into serving armed forces personnel, a staggering 11 stemmed from far-right concerns. And those concerns have been fueled by images such as this one from 2019. British paratroopers using pictures of former Labour Party leader Jeremy Corbyn for target practice. Or this video from a year earlier of notorious far-right English Defence League founder known as Tommy Robinson, surrounded by a group of young infantrymen.
Last year, the UK's top counter-terrorism officer said the fastest-growing UK terrorist threat came from the far right. A year later, the threat is still there, with critics saying the government is not taking the threat seriously enough. Saeed Bouriza, London.
Our guest joining us for this edition of the debate, Ian Williams, is senior analyst at Foreign Policy and Focus, joining us from New York. We also have Saeed Mohsen Abbas, who's a journalist and political commentator, joining us from London. Welcome to you both. Saeed Mohsen Abbas, let me first start with you. Let me ask a general question first, in terms of the UK as a whole. Does the UK have a problem with far-right groups and extreme or far-right ideology?
It certainly does have a problem with far-right. Of course, the coronavirus and COVID-19 have kind of overtaken the headlines. That doesn't mean that such organizations don't exist or have stopped operating. Far from it. It was very clear that these organizations were now at the stage of becoming militarily and, arms-wise, completely ready to take various action. And we've seen evidence of violent extremism of that kind across Europe. But in England, whilst it hasn't manifested in a mass killing as such, what has happened is the rallies that these organizations, like the EDL, the English Defence League, and various others, have begun to get more and more nasty and vicious. I know journalists, seasoned journalists, who've dealt with this issue, racism, the far right, and the kind of violent far right, if you like, They've been dealing with them for decades. Around last year, one of those journalists very openly confided me and said, look, it's no longer safe for me to actually go to the rallies and the demonstrations because these people have gone to another level and I'm worried about my life. She was seriously saying that actually she felt threatened in terms of her own life by becoming too, if you like, engaging with these far-right organizations. That's the state of the rallies and those gatherings. Can you imagine behind the scenes what may be going on in terms of the organization, the planning, the strategic directions that they might be receiving? And what worries me even more is that this climate of hate, which has been created by not just far-right organizations, but rather by the British media, by British institutions, the political institutions themselves, which are overtly racist and Islamophobic. Boris Johnson, you only have to recall his statements around women in letterboxes for women who wear niqabs, for instance, which, to give you an indication of just how Islamophobic and racist the leadership itself is at the moment. Well, as it filters down into the more the nasty elements, of course, that sentiment becomes one of action. The military, of course, is a place where people can get trained. And that's what's most worrying about these figures and the inaction of the government. So, yes, Britain has a huge problem of Islamophobia, which it sweeps under the carpet. And, of course, the cutting edge of that will be the rise of these terrorist right-wing groups.
Okay. Well, let's get to that, Ian Williams. You have soldiers, Air Force, and Naval personnel who were among those that were investigated. The report covered that. It was over the course of 2.5 years under a program called PREVENT, which investigates far-right extremism and UK soldiers. Does the fact that this program was required to be launched show that there was actually a problem within the UK military personnel with radicalization?
I'm somewhat amazed that they only investigated 11 or 14. If that's the scale of the problem, then it's under control. But I don't believe that. I believe they're only investigating the most egregious examples. What struck me is that people have resurrected. There's a checklist that the army itself produced for almost 5 years ago on indicators and warnings for extreme right wing. And looking through that checklist, most of the present conservative cabinet were probably qualified. Certainly most of the American Congress would. A lot of the police would. I mean, they describe, it says that, look for individuals, it says, for people in the military who describe themselves as patriots. Look for people who describe their opponents as traitors. Look at people who use the term Islamofascism. You know, and you look at people ready to challenge their views as indoctrinated. You refer to political correctness as some left-wing or communist plot. Top marks whoever drew up this list. It's, you know, it's fairly effective and comprehensive, and it applies to a considerable degree of American society, British society, and newspaper editors as well. But to put this in perspective, recently something like half, I think it was, with the French gendarmerie, said that they would be voting for Le Pen, you know, a descendant of the Vichy regime in Germany. Were there. So, you know, I think Britain has a problem, but I don't think it's completely unique. The question is, how do you combat it? There is always an attraction from the right wing for military uniforms and you shout patriotism. The redeeming grace in the British Army is that they can't get enough recruits.
Well, let me jump in here. Let me jump in here, Ian Williams. I'd like to find out from you because I'd like to actually have you clarify this. Is it in terms of the attraction? Is it coming from, as you mentioned, the far-right groups who are going after military personnel, or are military personnel attracted to the far-right ideology and then they become radicalized? Because there is a difference here.
Now, I think they're mutually reinforcing processes. You know, Britain's never had a real tradition of idolatry for the military the way that the Americans have, for example. If you go to Britain and say, I'm a veteran, they say, so? You're retired, what's your problem? You know, the veterans are not put on a pedestal. If somebody said, I serve, they say, so? It's there's a sort of pragmatic attitude that doesn't glorify the military, despite the best efforts of the Sun, the Express, and the rest of the press. The military are more a normal part of society. But it is getting complicated by the fact that, and it's been 40 years since there was conscription in Britain. It's a professional army. People volunteer to join, the forces in general. And the military, the actual army tends to be less skilled, let us say. You need a degrees of skill to be a sailor or an air forceman. And these are people who very likely couldn't get jobs elsewhere, and they're recruited. Mm-hmm. They tend to come from those sectors of society which tend to those views anyway. But I've got to say, I've been with the British military and other militaries on UN peacekeeping forces, reporting, and I've never seen really overt racism, casual racism of the kind that I expected, frankly. Partly because they're so mixed in themselves. Unless you're in the top guards regiments, it reflects the society, which is a multi-ethnic one. But yes, there have been lots of reports of real racism against the two paratroopers. One a court case on discrimination a year or so ago because of the racist treatment they were getting. I think the real issue is whether the officers and the military establishment take it serious enough to combat it, and they don't nudge and wink at it. But it's bound to be a serious problem. And remember, this is the military that some of whose members were alleged to be plotting a coup against Harold Wilson because he was such a left-wing prime minister.
We're going to get
pragmatic social democrat ever, and the military will work with newspaper proprietors.
Well, we're going to get to some examples of some of these military personnel in a second. But it's interesting, Ian Williams, that you say, could the figures actually be higher? You kind of posed that question, and Saeed Mohsen Abbas, I'd like to expand on that, because it seems like it is, based on Nick Lowles, who's Hope Not Hate's chief executive. He has said the referrals of so many serving military personnel to prevent the program, and general rise, then he went on to say, of violent far-right extremism in society as a whole. So that right there kind of points to the fact that the numbers couldn't just be 14 cases. So this could be a lot higher. Do you think that they're trying to conceal this figure, limiting it to it being reported to just 14 cases?
Inevitably, institutions will cover their own back.
This is for you, Samos. Go ahead.
Sorry. I think it's inevitable that, institutions in Britain or anywhere across the West that I know would try to suppress or deflect or cover up the kind of endemic institutionalized racism that exists within them. I mean, the Met Police here have been caught out so many times. Statistics exist left, right, and center. It's not been resolved. It's not been dealt with in an adequate manner. The British military is no different. I think it's just even probably more secretive and even more capable of making excuses to cover these things up in the interests, well, in the national interest, I would imagine. But look, we know for a fact, of course, that as my colleague said, the kind of people that do get recruited in the lower ranks of the British Army, they come from the kind of backgrounds where they're not exactly going to be blessed with great knowledge or history, historical knowledge of either the areas they go to, or nor is it actually probably part of their training. I've dealt with the British military at one level. They do have a section which deals with cultural, issues so that the soldiers could better adapt to environments like Afghanistan, for instance, or Iraq, or all the umpteenth number of other places which essentially NATO, the British, the Americans have been going and spreading their own particular form of democracy. As we know, across the Muslim world, we've been blessed with British, American, and other troops coming in to give us democracy, give them supposedly human rights, peace, initiatives, what tends to end up happening is brutal war and the indiscriminate killing of civilians on an absolutely industrial scale, whether it's in Iraq, Afghanistan and beyond. Millions have been subject to that kind of process. Uh-huh. Now, the soldiers that go there, of course, their job is not to empathize or sympathize. It's there to do the job that they're given to do. Now, that job is essentially to, at the extreme end, kill people. That's what the job of an army is. And the kind of people that you recruit to do that really don't ask too many questions. So the blowback from such an ongoing, if you like, imperialist or British stroke American, I call it Anglo imperialism across the entire Muslim world in particular, or the Middle East essentially, to protect the British interests, has been all about being brutal, really, and all about being very cold, callous in the interests of British economics, policy, or the politics. So
okay.
These soldiers really are part and parcel of a machine which is creating blowback, the blowback which can come back to Britain in many, many shapes and forms. And of course, when you've got a society which has been groomed now on the idea of ISIS and Islam being one and the same, terrorism in our own capitals here in the West being linked directly to Muslims, migrants, as was mentioned earlier, and add to that such things as Brexit and the nationalism of the Scots. There is a growing environment of if you like, hatred and fear and insularity, which I think can be taken advantage of by anybody inside institutions or outside British institutions.
Well, let's talk about a case here that is pretty jaw-dropping in Williams, and it involves two naval personnel, which included one who was due to work on a Trident nuclear submarine, and they were exposed as members of the far-right Identitarian movement. It's a movement which has links to a banned terrorist organization. I'm just, you know, I'm curious as to how, what kind of vetting process could there have been, or what kind of, how could that
well,
go under
found,
the radar?
So the vetting process is there and working. Look, if these right groups wanted to go deep undercover, they wouldn't allow their infiltrators to show their colors in public like that. This is, if you remember, the Bolsheviks infiltrated the Tsarist army, which is one of the reasons for the Russian Revolution. they subverted the army. You know, it's if people want power, they can infiltrate people in there. That one of the pluses of Britain is that the army has relatively been out of politics. One of the, we haven't mentioned, but we also have to consider the deleterious effect of 30 or 40 years of the troubles in Ireland, where the army was involved in secret undercover activities and was actually, fighting against what, on the face of it, were their own people. Because if you want to be callous about it, it's one thing for them to go out to the Empire and shoot up people in Arden and Cyprus and Kenya. It's when they come back and transfer those activities back home that it becomes, how should we say, a threat to the body politic. I'm not saying it's good, but when the army gets used to shooting their own people and infiltrating their own people and taking part in active politics in their own political system, as they did in Ireland, that is a very worrying trend. And it doesn't in any way condone the overt racism about ethnic minorities, but the Irish thing has really twisted the British force, the British Army, because the Air Force and Navy weren't involved much.
I got two important questions to ask, but I unfortunately have a couple minutes here on Say Muslim Abbas. I'm going to take this one question, which shook the entire UK, and that was when the British police officer who was charged with the murder of Sarah Everard, if you remember that, I'm sure. You know, you have a police officer that mentally somehow something went wrong. So I'm curious, this is the type of radicalization that is a result of perhaps the psyche, the UK service member or police in this case, psyche, going into that radicalization, being brainwashed in a sense to be that way, which results in this type of incident. Is that a deduction that can be made?
I think that there's far more evidence, as I said, on the ground of people who are prepared to do things. But of course, we live in an era now where these fellows are technologically literate. They're being developed, arguably, also by strategists from across Europe. It's even possible, and this has been mooted by certain circles, allegedly, that actually even deep state, British deep state itself, is allowing some of these groups to continue their activities, and they know perfectly well that they're armed and ready. But actually, these sort of right-wing groups could serve a purpose, and in fact, they're allowed to continue because they counteract certain other forces in society. So this notion that MI6, MI5, and the security services don't know about these organizations and can't shut them down, to me, is incredible. I think that they could easily hunt down all of these groups and pick them up and pretty much shut down the whole situation. I mean, the fact that a Lance Corporal in 2018, Mikko Vivalinen, I think, joined a group called the neo-Nazi, well, it was a neo-Nazi group, National Action, and still joined the army, is a worrying sign. But actually, it's the ones who are covert and who haven't showed themselves to be within these kind of racist, overtly racist and violently extreme organizations that are more worrying, because I think there's a huge underbelly of those folk who are ready to take action against British citizens and beyond.
Okay. I can squeeze in a 30-second answer to you, Ian Williams. My other question has to deal with the way that the UK has actually defined this whole extremism, its definition, which some are saying is controversial and weak in terms of the way that it has defined it. The current government's been decried as unfit for purpose, some have said, with some far-right groups even using it to their advantage. Is that the case? 30 seconds.
Yes, they are looking after it. Well, our enemy here is lack of transparency and impunity for the security forces and the police forces. The idea that they can do whatever they like and they're not subject to scrutiny and their personnel will get an easy ride. It's the same as the police departments in the US. It's the same with the security services everywhere in the world.
Unfortunately, I got to jump in here. We're just fresh out of time. That's Ian Williams talking there, senior analyst at Foreign Policy and Focus. Thank you. And Saeed Mohsin Abbas, thank you so much, journalist and political commentator. And that does it for this edition of Debate. From Mikhail Taiwei and the entire team in the capital, Tehran, it's goodbye until next time.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. This is A to Z, coming to you from IRIB English Radio, and I'm your host, Ali. This radio show is about Islamic lifestyle, and in each episode, we will be talking about a different lesson. Please stay with us till the end of today's program. Today's lesson, the solution to self-conceit. We must take the devotion and piety of the prophets and infallible imams as a model. brothers and sisters, remember this is the solution of self-conceit. If we do not take prophets and imams to be our role models, those ultimate role models, then remember, we are going to become a victim of this attack of shaitan. When Imam Baqir alayhi salam, the fifth infallible imam, sees Imam Sajjad alayhi salam with his devotion, and you know, the Sahifa, the supplications book, prayer, recitation of the Quran, prolonged prostrations, weeping out of fear of Allah, he cannot help weeping. The father calls him saying, bring me some of the papers containing the supplications of Amir al-Mu'mineen, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam. When they're brought, he looks at, puts them on the floor and says, how can your father's worship be compared to Ali's worship? In other tradition, it is narrated that who has the power to practice Ali's worship? Now, who is saying this? Imam Sajjad alayhi salam, who is known for his worship. He's telling his son, Imam Baqir alayhi salam, this is how you deal with and tackle with self-conceit. Brothers and sisters, when you feel that your worships have become too good, right? MashaAllah, you're focused and you're connecting to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Right at that point, shaitan is going to attack you. And at that point, if you don't turn back to Ahlul Bayt, their seerah, their method and their way, and you do not look up to Imam Sajjad alayhi salam and Imam Ali alayhi salam and the infallible imams, then you're going to become a very easy target for shaitan to fall in the pit of self-conceit. Welcome back to your listeners. Today we are discussing the solution to self-conceit. We know it's a spiritual disease, we know it's an akhlaqi and a moral and ethical disease, but what is the solution? How can one protect himself or herself from self-conceit? Well, in the Sabah morning supplication, Imam Sajjad alayhi salam says, O Lord, my heart is veiled to see you, and myself is sick and defective. Passions have overcome me. My devotion is little. My sins are abundant, and my tongue confesses my sins. See, Imam Sajjad alayhi salam is teaching us here that in order for you to stay protected against self-conceit and the attacks of shaitan and your nafs, this is how you turn towards Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. In this dua, see how Imam is teaching us to confess your shortcomings in front of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So you start feeling humble towards Allah. Your heart is actually submissive towards Allah at that point. Addressing Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in Abu Hamza's supplication, Imam Sajjad alayhi salam again says, your good comes down to us and our evils go up to you. But this does not prevent you from showering us with your blessings and being kind to us with your inward and outward blessings. Help me to weep over myself, for I have wasted my life with false desires. See how again Imam Sajjad alayhi salam is guiding us. This is like we would have been destroyed, annihilated, if the infallible imams were not a guide from Allah for us. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parsetoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.